irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Greetings to all of you listening around the world, and a warm welcome as we bring you another edition of the Answers for the Family radio show. I am Gabriella Van Rey, your guest host and founder of the Dare to Be Kind movement, speaker and author. You often hear me say, we as a society have dropped the ball on human kindness, and I ask people collectively worldwide to help me pick it up and to be the difference in other people's lives. I've now been a guest host for a few times, and I learned that Alan really looks at this show as a way for all of us to make a positive difference in the lives of others. And he needs your help to become a show ambassador who will forward at least one show to your social media group or to someone you know that can benefit from a particular topic. Each week, this show will address issues such as locating runaway teens, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, increasing our quality of life and longevity, and so much more. Alan has told me many times that he and Jan Shapen, the show producer, choose top professionals in many of the helping fields and skilled authors that they believe are working to make this world a better place for all of us. And today, I am so happy to introduce to you our guest that will talk about resilience, powerful practices for bouncing back from disappointment, difficulty, and even disaster. Linda Graham is an experienced psychotherapist who integrates modern neuroscience, mindful practices, and relational psychology in her international trainings on resilience and well-being. She is the author of the book Resilience and also Bouncing Back, the winner of a 2013 Books for a Better Life Award. Everyone knows what it's like to be knocked off center, to lose their inner sense of balance and groundedness, at least temporarily, when faced with life's unwanted curveballs. Whether it's a troubling health diagnosis, the death of a loved one, or a serious car accident, a layoff, or a natural disaster, life can intensely challenge our resilience, says Linda. In Resilience, Powerful Practices for Bouncing Back from Disappointment, the author and psychotherapist Linda Graham guides readers step by step through a process of cultivating more well-being in their lives by strengthening their resilience so that they can respond skillfully to any upset or catastrophe that would derail that well-being. Graham explains that resilience is truly recoverable. She has designed this toolkit specifically as a brain training program to help readers strengthen their capacity to bounce back. More than 130 experiential exercises train the brain, the practices Graham offers in resilience. Tap and strengthen the brain phenomenal ability to adapt. They are organized by the five different kinds of intelligence that are foundational to resilience: somatic, emotional, relational, within ourselves, relational with others, and reflective. In this book, we can reliably use Linda's methods to build or recover our resilience so that we can cope with whatever challenges or catastrophes might come along, next to cope with anything and anything at all. Linda, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Gabriella. Very happy to be here.
I love the word resilience. So the first thing I would love to ask you is, what is the definition of that word and what does it mean to you?
So the definitions of resilience keep evolving as researchers study what helps people be resilient. We're looking at capacities to recover from a difficulty or even a disaster, to cope with adversity, to bounce back and recover our baseline. And now people are seeing that there are three factors that help determine how resilient someone might be. One is the severity of the external stressors. So we may be involved in a fender bender kind of accident, or an accident that totals the car, or an accident that injures or kills someone. So the severity of the external stressor is an example. There's also the strength of our external resources. So if we're supported by family and friends and community and have access to savings or hospital care or the resources that come from other people. And then there's also our internal resources, so the qualities that we may have already of grit and determination, hardiness, courage, and also bringing in qualities of clarity and compassion and being able to be calm. The neuroscience now helps us understand that resilience really is capacities of responding to situations flexibly, being able to see alternatives and shift gears. And when we can perceive and shift how we're responding to a situation, then we can be more adaptive, more flexible. So my friend and colleague, Frankie Perez, says, how you respond to the issue is the issue. So resilience training really is strengthening the capacities in our brain to perceive and respond to many different kinds of situations with more flexibility, more skill, more adaptability. And the exercises that are offered in the book are all intended to help people strengthen that capacity of response flexibility.
I love that word flexibility, actually. I really do, because it almost sounds, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but it almost sounds like that you almost tell us that we're all, first of all, capable of it, and two, that flexibility is just a muscle. And like you were saying, you have 130 exercises in your book. Is that correct?
Right, that's right.
Wow. So you make it almost sound like if we don't have resilience from our grit or the internal person, that we can learn to adapt to literally anything.
Right.
Wow.
So as the neuroscientists make clear that the brain can change and grow lifelong, even as adults, then we learn that we are capable of strengthening those capacities. We're capable of learning. The way I teach in the book is little and often to do small exercises, but to repeat them many times, because that's how the brain learns and changes the best. And it is like building muscles at the gym. You do the exercises in small doses, you repeat them many times, and over time, the brain begins to install new neural circuitry or rewire the old circuitry so that the new patterns, the new habits begin to become automatic, and we're able to respond in new, more flexible ways without even having to think about it.
Wow. How come, Linda, that some of us, as you know more than I do, I have friends that react to potential trauma completely different than I would. So why do some of us fall apart at the seams and other people feel like they're actually growing from it? They almost welcome it.
So it's excellent question. Resilience is a capacity that's learned, and we learn it from the people around us as we're growing up, not just as role models, but as those people seeing us as resilient and helping us learn how we can cope with disappointment and with change. And so if we don't have those role models, if we don't have that kind of learning in our upbringing, where we can learn to be flexible, then we need to be able to learn that on our own later, and fortunately we can. So one of the things that I stress in the book is, regardless of history, regardless of the conditioning, regardless of what we have learned or not learned from our parents or from our culture, we can strengthen these capacities. So a huge part of the emphasis of the book is that we have a choice. And I put together two quotes, one from my friend Janet Friedman, "Catch the moment, make a choice," and from the environmental activist Julia Butterfly Hill, "Every moment has a choice and every choice has an impact." So when we put that together, catch the moment, make a choice, every moment has a choice, every choice has an impact, we see that by the choices we make, moment by moment by moment by moment, we're changing our perceptions, we're changing our responses, we're developing those skills of becoming more resilient. So I think resilience really is a foundational practice, whether we're dealing with the loss of a job or the loss of health or the loss of a relationship or the loss of a home or the loss of our hope. Whatever we're dealing with, we have a choice of how we're going to respond to it. And that's what the new field of post-traumatic growth is making clear, that very often people can survive horrendous, unbelievable, catastrophic disruptions to their life as they knew it, and they still can come out with a sense of new meaning, new purpose, new direction, a new sense of family or community. And so as we look at what helps people do that, certainly the idea of we have a choice of how we respond and how we learn from what's happening, that's what allows us to move from the stress or trauma into post-traumatic growth and even thriving.
Love it. And you almost make it sound, too, that for the adults that are listening, that it's a total myth when they say, oh, my child is so resilient, because we often equate this to children and children only. And you're definitely, with what you're saying that this is open to everyone. And so
human beings have to be resilient all of their lives. That's part of the human condition, whether you're in the first grade or in college or retiring. We're facing change. We're facing disappointment. We're facing, you know, difficulties. Every human being is called upon to be resilient, and we hopefully learn that from our parents and from our culture. But when we don't, we can learn it now, through tools like this. And there's a resilience training that we can go through. And this book is one of those models of that kind of training.
I love it. Would you say that we are innately born with an amount of resilience to start off with, or not at all?
Well, we're born with capacities in the brain. And all of those capacities grow as we develop. I mean, we learn to walk and we learn to talk and we learn to make decisions and we learn to be resilient. So the capacity is there innately, but it develops as all capacities in the brain develop by experience. Mm-hmm. We have to experience things and learn from experience, and that's how the brain changes. That's how the brain grows. So the more experiences we have of being flexible and adaptive and skillful, the more easily the brain is going to learn how to do that. So all of resilience is developed through experience, as everything is developed through experience.
You talk about change our brains to change our lives for the better. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. We're all born with ingrained survival responses. We have that from day one. So our nervous systems are already capable of responding to a sense of safety or responding to a sense of threat or danger by activating, and we take action to solve the problem, or by withdrawing, calming down, to get out of danger. And as we grow, we learn how to regulate that nervous system. We learn how to manage the emotions that are evoked every time we experience something. We learn how to relate to ourselves, we hope, with kindness and acceptance and appreciation. That's part of the inner secure base of resilience. We learn how to relate to other people as resources and as refuges in times of trouble. And then we learn, ultimately, we do learn how to use our reflective intelligence, how to use the capacity of the higher brain to see what's happening, see our reactions to what's happening, see alternatives, and make some wise choices, able to see the consequences of those choices. So all of that can be learned and cultivated step by step.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I'm going to have to read your book entirely. Very, very interested in this topic. Okay,
Wait, Gabriella, let me say about the book. It's meant to be an overall program that people build step by step. Okay. Certainly you can go in and find any exercise that would be useful for a particular trigger or a particular circumstance and practice it and do it over and over again. People can find the exercises that are the most useful for them. But the entire program, the entire book, is to train the brain itself to become more resilient. So that's what we're really aiming for, to have a brain functioning. It's interesting, you know, as you focus this radio show on kindness, and the research is showing that when people practice kindness or they practice any positive pro-social emotion like generosity or joy or awe, compassion, when people practice those positive emotions on a regular basis, it actually brings the functioning of the brain out of contraction, out of negativity, out of reactivity, into a more open perspective, more curiosity, more receptivity to learning, being able to see the bigger picture. So one of the direct, measurable, cause and effect outcomes of practicing kindness is resilience. The researchers can document that. So the more that we practice these positive emotions, gratitude, kindness, compassion, etc., the more resilient our brain is going to be, the more resilient we'll be in our behaviors.
I love that you say that, because my quote on my website is kindness only grows more kindness.
Mm-hmm.
And it really does, because you're positive, right?
So we'll exchange quotes here. Martin Seligman, who's the founder of the positive psychology movement, says that kindness, doing a kindness for another person, produces the single most reliable increase in well-being of any exercise we have tested.
Yay! Love it!
So kindness is a powerful change agent because it changes the brain.
Yeah. And you feel it. You feel it like a... sorry, I speak French sometimes, so I say it with a funny accent, but the physiology of our bodies, you just feel it in your whole body. I always say...
Okay, so let me say this. Sorry, I am interrupting. But when you're with another person, this is from Barbara Fredrickson in her book Love 2.0, when you're in physical proximity with another human being, and you're making eye contact, and you're sharing a positive emotion like kindness or gratitude, and you're sharing a sense of mutual care and concern, the functioning of the brains of the two people changes. And the brains of the two people begin to fire at the same neural frequency, and the neural chemistry begins to sync up, and it generates a feeling you can feel inside the body of what she calls love. It's what I call resonance. And so, yes, we can feel a shift in our physiology and in our emotions and even in our sense of self and the other person from practicing kindness.
Yeah, thank you. I could go on and on about this, but I'm back to your book. I love it. Thank you, Linda. I would love to know about the five intelligence that you talk about in the book, what that is. I'm so curious about that one. Please give a little...
I organized the book by those intelligences because that's how we learn. That's how the brain develops the best from the bottom up. So we begin with body-based practices that actually help restore the natural physiological equilibrium of the nervous system so that we feel safe, and from there we can begin to discern our options and decide how to respond. So practices of breath and touch and movement and visualization, using our body-based tools to regulate the nervous system. And I can come back and give examples of that. Then the next is our emotional intelligence, because we need to be able to, just like we regulate our nervous system, to be not too revved up and not too shut down. There's a range of resilience in the middle. We have to manage our emotions so that we're not flooded by negative emotions, or we're not running away from them, and we're able to use the positive emotions to create this shift in brain functioning. So we learn to attune to and manage our own emotions, and we learn to attune to and empathize with the emotions of other people. And then we have relational intelligence within, which is simply the self-awareness and self-acceptance that creates the inner secure base of resilience, so that we trust ourselves, we trust our own capacities, that we're going to be able to deal with whatever happens, no matter how difficult it is. And then the relational intelligence with other people, in terms of resilience, being able to call on other people as refuges or resources and be able to be that for other people. Because the truth is, we need to be able to cope with stress and trauma by calling on the resources and support of other people. It's very difficult to do this all by ourselves. And then the reflective intelligence, which is our capacities of mindfulness, to pause and become present and notice what's happening, being able to name what's happening, being able to step back from what's happening and disentangle from it and observe it in a more neutral way. And then to be able to discern what the options might be, shifting our perspectives and choosing the new wise action to take. So mindfulness simply helps us be aware of what we're experiencing and aware of how we're reacting to what we're experiencing, and being able to accept this is what's happening and accept ourselves for however we're reacting. This is who I am and how I'm reacting. So we learn those intelligences from the bottom up, so that by the time we get to reflective intelligence and mindfulness, we're able to combine our capacities to be with the experience, with the functioning of the higher brain, our center of executive functioning, to decide what we're going to do about it, to make decisions and to make judgments. So we've built that capacity from the bottom up. We're not just reacting out of old patterns or out of ideas.
Absolutely. There's one that you mentioned there that I instantly made a little notation, and the one that when you said trusting yourself, is that any chance do other men and women say that's one of the hardest ones, or in your professional opinion, would you say that's the one that we have the hardest time with of the five intelligences?
Well, sometimes we can trust our capacities or our competence, but we don't necessarily trust that we are worthy or deserving of being competent and being resilient and, you know, being able to cope and take care of business. So a lot of the exercises in that relational intelligence within ourselves is to be able to deal with shame and the inner critic, which is the biggest derailer that we have of our resilience, when we feel like we're a failure or not lovable. And so a lot of the exercises are to help a person really see their good qualities, but see also all the qualities that they would consider negative, and be able to accept them and integrate them as part of all of who we are. And so that we're not fighting within ourselves, we can feel whole and authentic within ourselves, and that's a foundational support for our resilience, that we're more able to take risks and risk making a mistake or a failure, because often we'll need to be able to do that to be resilient.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Love it. Now, I heard that you have an exercise in your book called Hand on the Heart. Would you tell us a little bit more about that one?
Yeah, this is one of the first exercises that I teach because it's so powerful and it's so immediate. And I can describe it and then I can talk about the science of why this works so well. But the idea is any time that there's a moment of startle or upset or distress or frustration, to place the hand on the heart center so that you feel the warm touch of your hand on your heart. And then you begin to breathe more slowly and deeply and gently into your heart center. And if you wish, breathing in a sense of ease or goodness or safety or trust. And then remembering a moment, just one moment, when you felt safe and loved and cherished with another human being. Not the whole relationship, but just one moment. And that could be with a parent or a spouse or a child, but it could also be with a friend or a coach or a therapist. It could be with a spiritual figure, and it could be with a pet, and pets are actually very good for this. So you're remembering a moment with this figure where you felt safe and loved and cherished, and you let the feeling that's evoked just kind of wash through your body, this kind of warm glow that washes through your body, and you hang out there for 10 or 20 or 30 seconds. Now, what's happening with that is when we put our hand on our heart center, that begins to activate the release of oxytocin, which is the brain's hormone of safety and trust, and the blood pressure begins to go down, the heart rate goes down. When we breathe more gently and deeply into the heart center, we're activating the parasympathetic branch of the nervous system. It's the calming, soothing branch. When we breathe in a sense of ease or goodness, we're actually restoring the coherent heart rate variability to the heart, which allows it to respond more flexibly to stressors. Then when we remember a moment of feeling safe and loved and cherished, that sense of safety and trust, the oxytocin that is evoked, is actually the brain's direct and immediate antidote to the stress hormone cortisol. So that when we feel safe and connected with other people, we're actually shifting the physiology in our body to come back into a sense of safety and trust. So this technique, hand on the heart, which I encourage people to practice many times a day at first so that it becomes a new habit, a new normal, this technique is powerful enough to calm down a panic attack in less than a minute. And it's powerful enough to preempt the stress response altogether so we can begin to feel the revving up and then it just kind of fades away and we come back to the calm range of resilience. So it's a tool that I teach everywhere I teach and recommend in the book and have on an audio recording because it's one of the most portable tools we have to restore equilibrium to the body. So I'm glad you asked about that.
And Linda, does it have to be on the heart part of the body?
Well, actually, you can place a warm, safe touch anywhere on the body, and that can begin to activate the caregiving hormone of oxytocin. Hand on the cheek, giving yourself a little hug, massaging the back of your neck. But there are neural cells, there are brain cells around the heart. So when you're putting your hand on your heart center, it's a very direct communication to the brain.
Okay. Because I do it naturally to myself, but I mm-hmm. do it under my belly button. So
Sure.
Your stomach. I've done it for years. And so I was mm-hmm. wondering if that was still okay.
Oh, yeah. In fact, many people can put one hand on the belly, one hand on the heart center, okay. and it creates a nice energy meridian in the body. Yeah.
Exactly. Okay. Super. Thank you for that. Now, mm-hmm. as the listener already knows, there's, you know what? I see the time. And I think before I'm going to ask you this question, we're going to go into a short little break. I think that will be probably a better idea because I have a feeling it might be a little bit long, the answer. But When we get back, I'm going to ask you your personal favorite exercise of the 130 exercises you have, okay? But for everyone listening out there, don't go away. Linda and I will be right back and we'll dive straight back into it. Thank you. Stay tuned.
Founded over 30 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, Westshield has continually focused on resolving issues that negatively impact families and businesses. Our signature therapeutic transportation service helps to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely transported to specialized schools, programs, and treatment centers with unsurpassed experience and success. We are supported by our full-service, licensed investigation agency that has legally, professionally, and compassionately located hundreds of runaways and teens. We are experienced and qualified to help, offering solutions which may include referrals to our international network of top professionals in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, psychiatry, and investigations. Simply put, Westshield Adolescent Services and Westshield Investigations are the best solutions when your family is facing a personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's 1-800-899-8585, or visit our website at westshield.com. Thank you.
Hi, everyone, and we're back with our guest, Linda Graham, an experienced psychotherapist who integrates modern neuroscience, mindfulness practices, and relational psychology in her international trainings. And we are talking about the topic resilience. Linda, I was just before the break going to ask you, in your book, you have 130 exercises. Which one is the one that you love the most and that you use the most?
So besides the hand on the heart that we talked about before the break, the next one probably is the self-compassion break. And this comes from the Mindful Self-Compassion Protocol that was developed by Chris Germer and Kristen Neff. And it is simply, again, putting the hand on the heart, but when you notice any suffering, beginning to say these phrases, may I be kind to myself in this moment. That's the first phrase. May I be kind to myself in this moment. And that breaks the automaticity of however we're reacting. It just brings us right to the present moment. Then may I accept this moment exactly as it is. Because the researchers have found that accepting what is happening is one of the most significant predictors of whether people will be able to move through stress and trauma into growth. So may I be kind to myself in this moment. May I accept this moment exactly as it is. And then the third one is, may I accept myself exactly as I am in this moment, because it's the self-acceptance of ourselves. Even if we're falling apart, we're getting angry, we're going ballistic, it's the acceptance of ourselves that allows us to change. As Carl Rogers said, the curious paradox is when I accept myself exactly as I am, then I can change. So we have those three phrases, and then the final phrase is, may I give myself all the compassion I need? So by just slowing down, becoming present, saying those phrases, we're actually shifting the functioning of our brain back out into something that's more open and receptive. We can actually bring the higher brain online again, and we can see what our choices and our possibilities might be. So again, that's an exercise that I teach all the time, everywhere. I ask people to practice it pretty regularly, not just when there's something to cope with, but just going through the day. You know, we need to be resilient, not just with difficulty, but often simply coping with whatever is new or unknown, because that can evoke an anxiety response in the body. So we practice resilience for new things as well, even when they might be very positive. But this practice allows us to position our functioning in an optimal way so that we're really able to see and respond clearly. So I teach that one to people regularly.
I love that you said that. I think that would be my favorite, this one that you just said, and I don't practice it enough. And you're right. some people get anxious very quickly when something shifts in their lives, or when there are just new things on the horizon that already scares them.
Let's just say it's built into the brain. It's built into the brain to have a signal anxiety when we face something new. Everyone will go through that. Uh-oh, I've never seen this before. Pay attention. So the brain alerts us to this is something new. Pay attention. It's how we respond to that signal anxiety. Oh, this could be an opportunity. This could be something new that I would actually enjoy or I could become competent at. So just to normalize that, how human that is, and then also to normalize when people say, I don't practice enough. This is being a human being. How normal is this? We all want to practice kindness. We all want to practice mindfulness. And then we go on about our days. You know, things take our attention. So to be, this is where the mindful self-compassion practice can be very useful if we start being critical or smallifying ourselves because we're not practicing enough. You're a human being. You're perfectly okay, or you're imperfectly okay, and we just keep going.
I always say I'm immensely flawed but incredibly happy with the flaws. You know?
Right, that kind of attitude of self-acceptance, yeah.
Yeah. I have a listener's question because a lot of people can, can call in, or people have already sent their questions to Alan Cardoza, and this person is asking the following question. Rebecca from Los Angeles is asking, I lost my husband to an auto accident a year ago, and it has been tremendous struggle staying afloat with no family close by. I am raising our daughter alone. I have been hit by feelings of helplessness, depression recently, and I know I should go for counseling. But between the demands of my work, my child, and the financial situation I am in right now, I just can't seem to make this happen. I listen to Alan's show almost every week and read a little about your book. I know it may not be a substitute for real counseling, but would it be a resource that could help me in the interim?
Well, so first of all, number one, compassion and care for the circumstances of losing your husband in an automobile accident and the grief and the loss and the uncertainty and the overwhelm that comes with that. And then having to raise a family on your own, that can be overwhelming and difficult. And then finding yourself sometimes in the helplessness or the depression, which is the shutting down of the nervous system. If it feels like everything we're trying isn't working to change the situation, then it's natural for the body brain to kind of withdraw, and we shut down into that helplessness or hopelessness. What is really important is to be able to activate and to do something, to take some wise action to cope with the helplessness, to cope with the depression. And it may not be as formal or as expensive as counseling, but the second step of coping with trauma after accepting what has happened is to be able to resource with other people. And if family is not near and if counseling is too expensive or time-consuming, then to be part of a support group of people who are going through grief, even a support group for people who have lost someone in a tragedy like an auto accident, so that you have a place to tell your story and a place to hear other people's stories, and you don't have to apologize or defend anything. Everything is just totally accepted, so that you can begin to normalize what you're experiencing, even enormous grief and overwhelm, and you can begin to hear from other people how they're coping or what's been helpful to them. So that is what I'm recommending. There's actually 5 steps of moving through a trauma, so to speak: accepting the reality, resourcing with other people, finding the positive even in the midst of the difficulty. And that can seem kind of counterintuitive, but it's really important to give the body brain a break, a respite, when we're dealing with something difficult. So enjoying a warm cup of coffee, playing with a pet, smelling a flower, having a favorite TV show, enjoying a positive moment between you and your family, It doesn't make the difficult go away, but it just makes it bearable. It makes it possible. Mm-hmm. And then the fourth step is finding any lesson, any learning in what has happened at all. Even if you can't change what has happened, what learning has happened as a result of it. And then putting all of that into a coherent narrative. This was life before. This happened. It's how life changed. It's how I've been coping with how life changes. It's how I can continue to cope. And finding that there will be life going forward, even revolving around this event. So there are steps we take to process through a tragedy or a trauma. And I mean, not ironically, our brains are hardwired. We are social brains. To reach out to other people for help and support is one of the best ways to come out of the depression. So that's what I would suggest.
Thank you, Linda, for that advice. I'm sure Rebecca will love that you were able to answer that question for her. Our next question is from Garrett from Oregon. I work with inner city teens in the after-school programs. The indifference and negative attitudes among our youth have been our main objectives to address in our work. I have dozens of books defining the problem with the general recommendations they all propose. I ordered your book, and after reading your experiential brain training exercises, I knew I had something solid with our kids. What you have given us is a full toolbox. I just wanted to thank you for writing this book. Mm-hmm.
So let me thank you very much. So what I want to comment on here is we're dealing with indifference or negativity among the kids, but the kids have probably dealt with indifference toward them, negativity toward them, neglect of them. And when there's been any of those experiences in a childhood, it is much harder to cope. It is much harder to have the flexibility and the resources in the brain to be able to cope. So to be able to bring these tools to them, a lot of self-acceptance and self-appreciation, but also a sense of competence, confidence that they can make a change, they can learn something new, is going to open up something to them. One of the tools that I teach in the reflective intelligence section is change every should to a could. Because when we're under the tyranny of the should, it sets us up for performance and expectation and failure and criticism. But when we change that to a could, it opens us up to possibility. So what a lot of the tools in this book do is open people back up to possibility. In fact, there's a whole section on using deconditioning, the processing of the brain that uses imagination and daydream and reverie, opening us up to what Dan Siegel at UCLA calls the plane of open possibilities. And that's really, really important for people to be able to be resilient. They have to see that there are possibilities in their circumstances, but also in their choices of behavior. So Thank you for the question. Thank you for the work that you're doing.
I have a question for you, Linda, and I'm not on the list of questions, but I'm thinking of it while you answered Garrett's, who didn't have a question, but who's working with youth, and I work with a lot of youth too, isn't the reason that they have the negative attitudes also because it's a coping mechanism to, not only because they've seen it and they've been treated that way, but it's easier to be negative and not show their emotions, and so they're basically hiding a little bit behind it?
Well, so let's understand that the scientists now know we have a negativity bias that's built into the brain. Negativity bias. We're going to perceive and remember a negative or a dangerous event more than we will remember a positive or a safe event. And that's built into the hardwiring of the brain by evolution so that we survive as individuals and as a species. If we don't pay attention to the negative, we're not going to go on living. So we have that in the brain. We're never not going to have that. We will notice a negative comment that a parent makes or a teacher makes or a coach makes or someone on the street makes, and we'll remember it, even though 19 other positive things were said to us during the day. We may make one mistake and do everything else well in a week, but we'll remember the one negative. So in order to work with that negativity bias, That's why we're practicing these positive emotions of kindness and gratitude and compassion and generosity and joy and awe and delight and serenity, because it's what directly counters that negativity bias. And so we deliberately focus the attention of the brain on something positive, not just so that we'll feel better, but so that we'll do better, we'll be more resilient. So just to know, yes, we deal with negativity a lot, but we make choices of how we respond to it.
True. There is another question that I really like to ask you is about shame. What role does shame play in resilience, and how can we move beyond that?
Well, to understand that shame plays a role in human culture, that parents and elders have to socialize a child growing up in the tribe or in the clan or in the society to behave, and to behave in such a way that you stay within the norms of the group, you stay within the protection and the acceptance and the love of the group. So whenever we do something that evokes disapproval from the group, then we are hardwired to feel shame. We are hardwired to feel badly about ourselves for that, and that is so that we will learn the behaviors that will keep us alive. The problem is we can internalize that sense of shame as an inner critic, and so we can be critical of ourselves even when we don't need to be, even when that's no longer useful. So the way to work with shame is to understand it has an important job to do, but it is not all of who we are. We don't have to believe its messages as eternally true. Mm-hmm. And begin to have compassion for ourselves for feeling the shame, and even begin to have some compassion and acceptance of the inner critic for the job that it is trying to do to keep us safe. And so we grow up and we say, okay, I get it. I'll take care of myself now. I'll make sure that I follow the rules or do what I need to do to stay in resonant connection with human beings. Inner critic, thank you very, very much for your service, and now you can retire and go to your room. So as we become more mature in our own holding of ourselves as whole people and as competent people and as resilient people, then we don't have to believe those messages of the inner critic anymore. We can trust that we're going to show up and take care of business, and we don't have to be criticized for how we're not doing that.
Lovely. Thank you so much, Linda. And unfortunately, our hour is up already. But I want to make sure that we leave the listener, how can they reach you?
So my website is www.lindagraham-m as in Mary, F as in Frank, T as in Tom, .net. So lindagraham-mft.net. And all of the, many of the exercises have been audio recorded, and there are interviews with other experts about resilience. There's the weekly resources for recovering resilience posts. There's a lot of things archived on the website as well as how to contact me.
Lovely. And everyone, if you're driving out there, don't worry. We will have her website on our website, and Alan will make sure the show is up for everyone and that you can learn and read more about Linda Graham. Thank you so much, Linda, for being on this show. Truly appreciated your topic. Very, very inspirational to hear your exercises. And I'm definitely going to do a few of them. And for everyone
thank you.
And for everyone out there, please put us on the calendar. Tune in next Monday when we are joined by Amber Ray, author of Choose Wonder Over Worry. And please visit our archives or our past interviews, and or go to answersforthefamily.com and subscribe to iTunes, Stitchers, YouTube, or Vimeo. There are many ways that you can help us reach more people by either posting one of our past interviews or talking about our show on Facebook or Twitter. Thank you very much, everyone, and continue to spread the good word and be the difference in someone's lives today. Goodbye.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.